Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to the World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. Happy Friday. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Had another great week, and glad to be getting through it. And we're working on a good series of shows, too. So if you're just joining us, we started the series on Monday, so we're not suggesting you go back and you can jump in at any point with tonight's show, but then you might want to go back and check out Monday and Wednesday's shows too. So, good stuff.
Yeah, you're going to want to swing back and hear the first part of this. In fact, I would say generally you want to go back and hear all the shows you haven't heard, but that's just me.
There's some goodness back there in those archives. Yeah.
Folks, don't deprive yourselves. That's all I'm saying. It's there for you. That's why we do it. So listen to these shows. But we have been doing a series, Big Questions About the Future of Humanity, based it on an article in Scientific American. They gave us 20 pretty darn good questions about the future of humanity, and they found an outstanding panel of experts to provide answers to those. We're reviewing the questions and giving a quick summary of what the experts said and then giving our own answers to these same questions, and we've got six to go.
We find ourselves largely in agreement with most of these experts, right, Phil? Sometimes we say we'll go a little further out on a limb, but I'm finding that most of what these guys are saying, I kind of agree with.
If you want to really just turn it into the whole ego trip for a moment, I think the experts are agreeing with us. And what I mean by that, okay, that sounds ridiculous. It sounds absolutely absurd. But what I mean by that is we don't have to push these experts into kind of a transhumanist, singularity aware, speculist kind of direction as much as I would have thought we do. You know what I mean? They're taking a pretty long view. They're taking a pretty expansive view. Occasionally we do that, right? We say, well, I would even add this, and I would even add that. But there's less of that going on than I would have thought. And generally speaking, these experts seem to see things getting better and technology being a big driver of that.
Well, we've been doing these kind of shows, Phil, since 2005. And I would tell you that when we first started doing these shows, if we did a show where we were looking at what the experts were saying, I mean, we'd have to completely revamp the answer. We'd have to say, these guys are blinded by the day-to-day in their own fields, and they don't see the big picture of where we're going. And we'd have to, future it up, right? Whereas it seems like that's less the case more and more as the years go by, more people get it.
They're catching up. Just to put it out there, okay? We've been saying this kind of stuff, and it seems like the world is coming online. Not that we invented this way of thinking. We are merely vessels of it by and large. But it's really interesting to see that transition occur, and very encouraging, to see that transition occur. All right. Well, let's not delay. We got a lot of stuff to do. Plus, we want to geek out a little bit here at the end of the show. So, question number 15, will we use wearable technologies to detect our emotions? And here we have Rosalind Picard, founder and director of the Effective Computing Research Group at MIT, at the MIT Media Lab. And interesting examples she gives of detecting emotions and using that to prevent I believe seizure is the example she gives. By knowing what's happening emotionally, we can actually prevent really negative health outcomes from occurring. Something I hadn't even thought about in terms of kind of the applications of being able to detect emotions. So what do you think, Stephen? Are we going to use wearables to detect our emotions? And if so, what will we do with that?
I think the technology will certainly exist, but we need a killer app for that, right? I mean, there needs to be a compelling reason to do it. And I think what you're talking about is maybe the compelling reason to do it. And that's, maybe a little alert, in your field of vision, because, you're wearing glasses that give you a little augmented reality, right? And you get a little alert in the little right corner of your vision that, hey, you're feeling a lot of anger. You might want to count to 10, do whatever you need to do, back away from whatever it is that's making you so angry. And because, I don't know about you, Phil, but decisions made in anger usually are not the best for me.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And so if I had a little, a little Jiminy Cricket app running, kind of being my conscience a little bit, saying, hey, Pinocchio, you need to calm it down, that might not be the worst thing. And so maybe that's the killer app that we need that would make such technology worthwhile. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think that would be the beginning of something like that. Longer term, and I really like the example she gives about being stressed out and how that leads to really bad things happening. And I think about, you're mad, look at your blood pressure, dude, right? I mean,
yeah.
Think about what you're doing to your body. That kind of feedback potentially could really change how people, choose to live their lives. Longer term, if the whole thing could be worked into kind of a feedback loop, that actually does something about your emotions. I mean, that is a much more complex, sophisticated set of technologies. But if you can just, take a deep breath and make the anger go away, great. Or if you could just set a dial and say, okay, you know what? I'm not going to be mad right now. I'm going to, I'm going to put all that away because I have that level of control over my brain. I think that'll be even more helpful. That's farther out. But ultimately, I think, wearable technologies are going to be detecting and doing all kinds of things with our emotions. I mean, when you think about it, it's part of our overall health profile, and they're going to be tracking everything else. We're going to be wearing computers
that
are going to be tracking our pulse and our breathing rate and our blood pressure and our blood sugar level and everything else. Why in the world wouldn't we be tracking those emotions when they have such profound impacts on our health? So, short answer.
So it will all be part of the quantified self that we will all experience when we have the tech to do it, right? So,
exactly right. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. How about this one? Will we ever figure out what dark matter is? Lisa Randall, Frank Baird, Jr., professor of science and theoretical physics and cosmology at Harvard, says it depends. And I like the answer. It depends on what dark matter actually is. If it's something that we can, it almost sounds kind of simple-minded, but if it's something that we can detect and understand, then we will. And if it's not, then we won't. This kind of throws dark matter right into the same category as consciousness, right? Will we ever understand what it is?
Right.
Well, it depends. If it's something we can understand, we'll understand things we can understand, but we won't understand things that we can't understand.
I think she's saying in part that if we can experiment on it, we'll our understanding will grow. But if it's one of those things we can't experiment with, then we're gonna remain in ignorance for the foreseeable future. And so I can understand that, but I know very little about this field, to be honest, but I'm hopeful that there'll be ways to experiment and to approach it, at least, at least metaphorically or mathematically or whatever, even if it can't be reproduced in a super collider or something. There ought to be ways to figure this out. And so maybe, yeah, I'm, She's just kind of saying maybe, maybe not. I think probably it might be my answer.
Yeah, well, for me, it all comes back to we've talked about through this series, who's we? What do you mean by we? And if we means, you know, people living in the early 21st century, human beings living in the early 21st century on Earth, then, you know, maybe we won't. But if we means remote post-human descendants of humanity, you know, 1,000 years from now, then I would say that their, you know, their ability to detect things, to interact with things, to have a scope on things, will so far transcend what we can do and what we can imagine doing that, you know, you just have to default to a yes on this. I think, yeah, we're, you know, we'll get to the bottom of dark matter and dark energy. Limitations around what we can detect right now will not be permanent. That's my take.
Yeah.
Okay. How about number 17? Will we get control of intractable brain diseases like schizophrenia or autism? The answer here is from Michael Gazzaniga, and he is with the University of California at Santa Barbara with the SAGE Center for Study of the Mind. And he talks about the problems around this is whether we should be looking at the neurons, whether we should be looking at the overall brain architecture, whether we should be looking at brain chemistry. There's just a lot of you know, still unanswered questions about exactly what's going on in the brain and how it all works and how it all works together. So it's hard to say for sure how we would get control of these intractable brain diseases. And so it's hard to say for sure whether we will. What do you think, Stephen?
I think whether it's this answer or that answer or that answer, we still get an answer. You know, we I think on, it was on Wednesday we talked about Alzheimer's, and it was just basically my thought there was that prevention probably be easier than the cure, but we get the cure too eventually.
Right. Right.
And you know, things like schizophrenia and autism show up in you know in children. I mean, it's harder to prevent something if it's already there. And so, you know, so this one might be a tougher nut to crack as far, you know, you can't really prevent it. You're just going to have to treat it. And, yeah, so it's going to, I think it's, we learn more about total brain architecture. We learn more about brain chemistry. We learn more about the individual neurons. And maybe the answer lies in all three of those areas, right? And
I mean, even
begin
if,
to
even
get
if
part
autism,
of the, get part of the answers everywhere.
Yeah, even if autism is a really exotic cocktail of those three things, we can eventually figure out what that is. Right? You know, even if schizophrenia involves, you know, a profoundly better understanding of neurons, brain chemistry, and brain architecture. Well, we get better at all of them, and we understand the relationships between them better. And I don't think these things remain elusive. I don't think they remain hidden forever. It's just a matter of growing our knowledge and getting models ultimately that are better than the ones we have. So, you know, the brain expert is you know, cautious about what kind of progress we make. We're not going to let that slow us down, Stephen. We're going to say, nah, we'll fix it. So, you know, take our answer for what it's worth. It's easy for us to say. But I think, you know, you can be in the weeds and maybe not understand the big picture, which is that we're just getting better and better at figuring these kinds of things out, and the knowledge is going to be there. Okay, number 18, will technology eliminate the need for animal testing in drug development? It's an important kind of question. And the answer from Donald Ingber, who is with the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University, is a good one. Talks about essentially how we're modeling, you know, human interactions using alternatives to animals, and why that's better, and why ultimately that makes it possible to eliminate the need for animal testing, that actually makes animal testing irrelevant. And I agree completely. I think you know, we're going to start testing on virtual humans, both as computer models and as, you know, complex tissues that we can now grow in vitro. I think it becomes less and less necessary to have an animal as a substitute. I think animals are often very poor substitutes for humans anyway. Their reactions to things are sometimes predictive of human reactions, but sometimes they are very misleading. And obviously there's the ethical issues around what you're doing to these animals in the process. Finally, it's better to develop drugs based on what they'll do to a human being. And I think that'll involve a two-pronged thing. We'll look at how they impact individual human tissues, which we'll have the capacity to do. And then we'll have to look at how they involve the overall human body system, the nervous system, circulatory system, you know, the human as a whole proposition. And that's going to require much more advanced AI, deep learning, artificial intelligence type modeling of what a human being is. But I don't see that as intractable. I think those two things work together. And we've talked about Watson going to medical school. This is one of the reasons we sent Watson to medical school. It is going to be a lot better at putting these kinds of things together and doing virtual tests of drugs that will probably be in many ways much more predictive than actual tests we're currently doing on animals. That's my take. What do you think?
I've got a two-part answer that's one part very hopeful and one part kind of a bummer. So let me give you the hopeful part first. I think ultimately we won't just have a virtual humans that we're testing. There'll be a virtual Phil and a virtual Steven. Personalized medicine to the point that they check and see how it will be, how Steven will tolerate this particular medicine. It looks like virtual Steven's doing pretty good with this. Let's give it – and in fact, it's making the condition better in virtual Steven. Let's give it to real Steven now and real Phil, you know.
Right.
I think we get there – it might be 20, 30 years down the road before we get to that level of sophistication with it. You know, we developed the virtual human first before we get to the personalized medicine that I'm talking about. But I think we get there often. But here's the kind of bummer part of it. I think we still need animal testing, and I think that our desire to move away from animal testing for ethical reasons is laudable, but maybe premature. And I would just caution those who are really pushing to, no more mice have to die, no more this, other animal testing at all. We need to get away from that. Think about the human lives too. That animal testing, has saved. And so let's not move away from animal testing before we're able to move away from animal testing. And
I don't think that's a problem at all. I think that's a completely realistic answer. I agree with that. I think that long term, I don't think we'll have it, just because we'll have a better way of doing it.
Agreed.
That ultimately you have a better way of doing it, and that's why you do it, because that saves more human lives. We're not there yet. It's like so many of these other things we talked about. We're still causing extinctions while we're trying to prevent them, right? We're a very imperfect phenomenon, humanity. In terms of what we'd like to do and what we actually end up achieving, but the goals are right. The goal is saving lives and making things better And we'll get there eventually without hurting animals. But to get there without hurting animals, we have to make it better than the method that hurts them. That's the ultimate pragmatic, pro-human answer to that question. And I agree with you completely. Okay, how about number 19? This is the kind of question that you and I are just so good at, I think, Stephen. When these kinds of questions come up, it's like, oh, finally, Phil and Stephen weighing in on this one. Will gender equality...
let's get them to weigh in, yeah.
Yeah, be achieved in the sciences. What do Phil and Stephen think about this? We've got Londa Scheibinger. She's a professor of the history of science at Stanford. And she says, it can happen. We have to be much more proactive in making it happen. We have to be recruiting women into the sciences. Talks about, systematic bias, systemic bias, and how that's eliminated. I'm not going to disagree with anything she says there. I just think in the long term, either we will eliminate gender inequality in the sciences, or will cease to be interested in the question.
Can I confess something regarding that? Can I confess that I'm completely disinterested in the question right now? To me,
no, that makes you sound like a bad person.
I can't confess that.
No,
here's my thought, and this comes from, a white man. So, if that means something to you, as a listener, then completely discount what I'm about to say. But my thought is, if you have a desire to do this kind of work, then by all means go do it, regardless of your gender, your race, or whatever. If you want to go into STEM fields and you're surrounded by a bunch of white guys, and that's not what you are, you're different race or gender, then go do it. And in fact, you more than likely will be greeted with open arms and well, great, we got somebody that's not another white guy or another another Asian guy or whatever, in these fields, and we're glad to have you. I'm just happy with the fact that we're progressing at the extent that we are. And I don't feel the need to, I feel less interested in this question than I should be, perhaps. But any rate, that's by all means, if you have the interest, go into it, and I suspect that you'll be greeted and welcomed. This is the sort of thing that people in women's studies complain about when they should have been in the STEM fields themselves. Let me believe it at that.
All right.
So,
okay.
that's completely unfair, but that's the way I feel about it. Anyway.
Well, the thing is, if you go into women's studies, there's a good chance you didn't have the aptitude or interest for STEM fields anyway. And that goes back to your earlier statement, which is if you're interested in it, right? If this is something you want to do, do it. And you know what? If everybody who's interested in it goes into it and has an aptitude for it, goes into it, that's great, because we got that many more scientists, which is wonderful. And in the end, I think the headcount in terms of how many men versus how many women is every bit as important as the headcount is to how many are redheads. Okay, how many people have big noses
And if you happen to care about that headcount, then I think if everybody that's interested in it goes into it, I think that it will kind of begin to even out.
That's my answer. My answer is either it evens out or we don't care anymore. Either it evens out or it just becomes an interesting demographic phenomenon where somebody says, did you know that the sciences are made up of 60% women and 40% men? I'd be like, no, I didn't know that. Now I'll go on with my
day. Cool.
Because I'm no more interested in that than I would be if it was the reverse. I'm just glad there's a lot of people going into science. I think that's where you and I are. And not to downplay hardships that may have occurred in the past for people going into those, or that still exist in a large part of the world for women who want to move into areas that have not been traditional fields for them. But I'm very optimistic that one goes away as a big problem. Okay, number 20. Do you think one day we'll be able to predict natural disasters such as earthquakes with warning times of days or hours? I like this one as just kind of a odd one to end on. You would have thought that the 20th question would have been, what's the ultimate fate of humanity or something like that? But they alphabetized them or something like that. So anyway, Richard Allen, director of Berkeley Seismological Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, he says that yes and no. That some things we'll be able to detect and prevent, and other things it's just much harder. There's a lot more chaos involved, a lot more complexity, and we're not going to be able to. My short answer to this one is yes, we will. Even the highly complex ones, we will get better and better at detecting what's going on under the covers, behind the scenes there, and that long-term natural disasters will be not only predictable, but ultimately preventable. That we'll be able to hedge those kinds of things off, and I'm guessing, Stephen, that you're pretty much on the same page.
Well, yeah, I would just say I'm probably a little closer to the expert here on this. I would just say that there's a lot of chaos involved in this, but I think what we do is we get something like you know, the ability to say with 90% accuracy, we're going to have a major earthquake in this region in the next 3 years.
Right.
You know, with 90% confidence, we can say that it's going to be a pretty big one here. If that bothers you, you better move on out of there, you know, because that's a high likelihood of a major earthquake here. We see the stress on this fault line, and it's just, and we feel pretty confident that that fault line is about to break. And so, you know, move on out of there. I think we're getting pretty close to that already. Now, the ability to say, hey, we're having an earthquake in the next 4 or 5 days, that's harder, I think.
Yeah.
But and to some extent, we would prefer the next 4 or 5 days, wouldn't we? You know, it's one thing to say, yeah, you're 90% chance of earthquake in the next 5 years. Oh, well, okay. And you just keep going about your life, and then all of a sudden, you know, you wake up in the middle of a terrible earthquake, right?
Yeah.
It almost would be better, you know, human nature being what it is, to say, you guys get out of there. You're having an earthquake in 2 days. Oh, well, gosh, yeah, I better.
Even if it was 3 weeks, right, you know, that would hit home.
Yeah.
It'd be like, okay, well, that's it, you know.
Yeah, I'm out of here. But, you know, 90% chance in the next 5 years, well, you know, okay, I'll get to it when I get to it kind of thing. And really, that's but I think ultimately we get better and better at that. But human nature is kind of funny, and that's that is what it is. But
yeah, well, ultimately I think we predict them much better, and I think we prevent them. You know, this is like Alzheimer's. This is like Alzheimer's of the planet. We don't have the technology right now to prevent earthquakes. We don't have the technology right now to prevent the Yellowstone, you know, caldera from blowing up, but we will. Eventually, we'll have geoengineering sufficient to address these kinds of problems. And rather than predicting earthquakes, we'll say, well, you know what, something might happen here, so let's go in and I don't know what it'll be, but let's do this thing that we can do that actually makes earthquakes less likely. And our prediction will actually become a big part of prevention. And you know, I don't know about you know, hurricanes or you know, weather control is that's an interesting and fun one too. But you know, I just see us as ultimately moving in a much more not a victim kind of relationship to this kind of stuff. That that we assume a level of control over these things with the goal of saving lives. Like so much of what else, you know, we're working on here. And long term, I think we will. I think we'll prevent earthquakes, we'll prevent hurricanes, and maybe even one day that Yellowstone caldera. That's my very positive end to the 20 big questions about humanity. And that means it's time for some other geek.
That's right. Well, we are, you know, at the point in the show, we would normally just call it a show at this point, but here's a little extra at the end. This is our other geek. Phil, you know, I want to ask you first, do you have any other geek before I jump into mine?
I don't have one this week, so I'm going to hear all about your gaming experience recently.
Okay. Viticulture is the game that I've been bringing out the last 2 or 3 weeks with my family, and I want to just tell you, it sounds like the driest thing in the world. It is a game in which you have your own vineyard, okay? And your job is to run this vineyard in such a way and as to be the best at running the vineyard in the game, right? Each player has their own, and so you know you're building trellises, you're putting in irrigation systems, you're putting out you're planting. And you're greeting guests to your vineyard, you're giving tours, you're building a cottage to have more, so you can bring in more guests because these guests are awesome for your vineyard. And, then, you know, you have wintertime harvest and then, you know, crush pads, and you've got, in addition to that, you've got the cellars. You got to enlarge your cellars, so you can do more complex and wines, and it's just and ultimately you fill wine orders, and it's just there's a lot to this game. It's just a lot to it. But it's you know, with three players, you can knock out a game in an hour, hour 15. We just, I mean, our family is really enjoyed it. It's funny. You'd think, well, that's one that the kids couldn't get into. My 10-year-old has played nearly every time we brought it out. He's right in there with me, and he has not won, but he lost by 1 point. The second to last time we played. So, I mean, he's competitive, and it's a fun game. I highly recommend Viticulture, and there's several different. It's almost confusing with the different editions that are available. If you're buying it for the first time, I recommend a Viticulture Essential Edition. Is what you
okay? And, we'll start with Viticulture Essential Edition. Well, let me tell you about this one because you've described a number of games in other geek installments over the weeks, but this one really brings something to mind, which is that the word gamification was really big 3-4 years ago in
right.
talking about making web smartphone apps, web apps, web experience more exciting for people, getting people more involved in doing sometimes mundane everyday work related tasks. But it just goes to show you that everything can become a game, right? There's nothing in this
right.
world that can't be turned into like an interesting, like dynamic competitive experience. Farmville, I guess, should have been the example of that anyhow. But, that you could get this specific, about this very interesting world of raising grapes and turning them into wine and making that into a business. That can become, I mean, we're talking like a board game, right? You roll dice and all that stuff.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really quite amazing.
Specific, this is in Tuscany. So you got a lira and everything else is part of the deal. Anyway, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. And the more we played it as a family, the more fun it gets because it's no longer getting these various mechanisms down. You kind of disappear into the game,
right?
Once you learn the mechanisms and say, okay, when this happens, you do this. When that, and at some point, you just kind of forget about that and sort of you're thinking as if you're running a running a vineyard. So it's fun. I do highly recommend Viticulture. It's one that should appeal to. A different segment of board gamer than you would normally think.
All right, if you're looking to try out a really unusual board game, Viticulture.
Yeah.
There you go. And it sounds like a lot of fun. Well, thank you for sharing that, Stephen. And it's been a great week talking with you about 20 big changes for humanity. We're going to be back again next week with maybe a less structured week. I don't know. Maybe we'll do some more wacky grab bag shows. We haven't done those in a while. But whatever it's going to be, we'll be back with more on the future next week. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, live to see it.